To the penultimate episode of the October Sky Minute podcast, the show where, in the Movies by Minutes tradition, we analyze, scrutinize, and celebrate the 1999 Joe Johnston-directed feature, October Sky, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an aerospace nerd from the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And Jim, joining us today, thanks to the magic of the internet, is Anthony Labate. He is in the moving image department at the George Eastman Museum. And we're going to have what we both know is going to be a fascinating discussion about preserving old films and that sort of thing and what they do at the museum. So, Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's great having you here. As I was saying before we started, your facilities are like Disney World to movie nerds like we are. But let's go over a little bit about what Minute 101 is. Here we are getting to the Where Are They Now stage of the movie. It starts with, in ITC Bookman font, telling us that the Rocket Boys all graduated from college. And we get to find out what happened with Quentin and Roy Lee, and we finish with seeing that Homer Hickam wound up working for NASA training astronauts to get into space, just like he had hoped for. And in between, we're seeing a bunch of home movies that Homer had collected over time, Hair in the Gate and Water Spots and everything. But it just shows that these are powerful home movies of what is, you know, what had turned from family history into knowledge that general audiences are watching. And Anthony, in your organization, you store all kinds of things, commercial, private collections, and I guess you probably get stacks of old Super 8 films and things coming across your desk and then asking, can we fix this? Is that pretty much where you're at?
Sometimes my colleagues and I, we have scanners that we work with now as we digitize films, and people will come to us with their home movies asking for them to be digitized so that they have them in a format that they can watch much easier because they might not even have projectors anymore that work. We also recommend that once we digitize a film, don't throw it away. As long as it's in good conditions, not decomposing, you might want to keep it because there might be something that comes along later on that's better than what we have now for scanning. So you can always get a better copy later on. Never throw away your originals.
Something you can watch on the holodeck when it's in centuries from now. Well, that's great. Can you tell us a little bit more about your organization? We haven't mentioned this, the Eastman Museum, and you have multiple conservation groups. I know there's the Kay Whitmer Conservation Area, and your department works on moving images. How did that come about in your organization?
Well, the museum was founded and opened in 1949. We just celebrated our 75th anniversary. And it was sort of in response. Museum of Modern Art was the first museum in the U.S. that had a moving image department. And George Eastman Museum was the second, where we started just to collect the films that maybe the Museum of Modern Art didn't think were important enough. Our first curator of moving images, James Card, believed in the philosophy. It was like, well, you can't just have the canon of films. You really need to see everything else as well to appreciate the history of moving images. And over the years, we've collected over 28,000 titles in the collection. And to this day, we still have more than 26 million feet of film still on nitrate-based film, the type that will burn.
Yeah.
But we can do in vaults that are very fireproof and very safe. And we store our films, nitrate or safety, at 40 degrees Fahrenheit with 30% relative humidity, cool and dry. We'll keep them as long as possible.
You and can lots of canisters of Halon in every corner, I would imagine. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Excuse me, Jim. Now, Anthony, I understood, if I was reading, remembering correctly from your website, that you're one of the a fairly small number of facilities that, you know, you not only store and preserve these nitrate films, but you can actually screen them. You have the equipment. Is that correct?
Yes. The Dryden Theater is one of, I believe, is four theaters left in the United States that still can legally show and project nitrate film. And I think we're the only ones on the East Coast. On the West Coast, they have the Academy Museum, the American Cinematheque, and the Stanford Theater in Palo Alto. And those can legally show nitrate.
And you're stressing legally there, and is that primarily because of the fire risk, or?
Yes, that's definitely because of the fire risk.
Okay.
The ports that the projectors shoot out of to the screen have to have metal shutters that would come down if should a fire happen in the projector. They also have to have rollers near the gate that will close if the fire catches at the if the film catches fire at the gate, so it protects the feed and the take up reels from burning.
Yeah, anyone who's ever seen nitrate film burn can attest that it's something you do not want to be around if a large quantity of it would go up. I'm really impressed by the amount. I've looked at some of the films that you've digitized and have restored that are available on your website there. It's really impressive that you're even doing like frame by frame restorations of the early attempts at color film. That must be quite a workload for your staff.
It is. We are at the moment very swamped with a number of projects. We're in the process of restoring a number of William S. Hart, the cowboy star, films from the teens. And we've done a worldwide search for the best available elements to try to bring these films back to their original length with every possible frame that we can find that would still be useful.
How do you go about sleuthing that? I was wondering, you know, you're saying like a worldwide search, and are you sending people to Buenos Aires to look in old theaters, or it'd be a great movie, I would think.
Not all the time. There's an organization called FIAF, the International Federation of Film Archives, and there's a website that they're called the Treasures from the FIAF archives that will list what archives hold what titles. That's a starting point. We also send out an email on that site asking, does anybody hold any material on a certain title? You know, 35 millimeter or 16 millimeter, just want to know what's out there. And then we'll sort of make a judgment of what might be the best materials. The closest, of course, to the original negative is what we're looking for. Any nitrate prints, hopefully original release, sometimes they're reissue prints, but we either get scans or they send them to us and we scan them, and then we can digitally restore them and then send those files to a lab to get printed back out onto 35 millimeter film.
There must be stories of people just showing up with something that you'd never expected to see. Have you ever had that experience of where did this come? Like, I'm picturing somebody finding, you know, London After Midnight under their bed or something. It's like, oh, what about this?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Yes.
We did find a fragment of another Lon Chaney film from like 1914. The title escapes me now. And how this happened, there was I believe a couple from Syracuse, New York, and they were moving to California. And about 10 years before, they were at an antique store and they bought a suitcase. And as they were planning to move to the West Coast, they finally opened the suitcase and there were a couple of reels of nitrate film in the suitcase that they were unaware of. And as they were heading out, driving out to the West Coast, they made a stop by and dropped the films off and donated them to us. And one was a fragment of a Lon Chaney film that was considered lost.
Wow.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. That would have been quite a surprise if they went by plane walking that through the TSA.
Right. That would not have been popular. Anthony, you mentioned something at the beginning that really struck a chord with me, that idea that, you know, it's not just sort of the canon of films or the, you know, 100 greatest films of all time or the sorts of curated things we'd expect, like at Library of Congress and things like that, how it's important to save the other things. And what came to my mind was, you know, Jim and I and our good buddy Brian, who designed our logo and all sorts of things, we're very much aficionados of things like World's Fairs, stuff like that. And I remember being so excited to start coming across, in the early days of YouTube and Internet Archive, things like that, some home movies, color home movies from some of the most prominent World's Fairs, and realizing that you know, back then these were just amateur home movies, and they maybe not have been, it wouldn't have been seen as having value, but now as little time capsules of glimpses of things that that hold such fascination. So with that in mind, I mean, I see that it for me personally, that value had expanded dramatically. So with all that said, what is your criteria for sort of accepting a film into the collection?
Well, we're known for a lot of silent cinema, Hollywood cinema. James Card was very fond of German cinema, so that's part of it. If we're accepting home movies, which we don't blanket accept them, that they would have to have some local or regional interest for us to take them into the collection, of course. And I know I would certainly lobby for this if anybody brought in some film from the 1939 New York World's Fair.
Oh my gosh.
We certainly would jump on that. We do have a few of those in the collection.
Wow.
But a lot of mainstream Hollywood films that we do collect. Early color cinematography is also another strong point in the collection.
So. I feel like I should have contacted you earlier, although I think the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was okay. I had managed to save the final or the only known reel of Frank Capra's last film, which was known as Rendezvous in Space, which was made for the 1964 World's Fair. And I had a friend of mine had saved this from a dumpster. It was shown in the Hall of Science at the World's Fair. And when they were renovating, they just like, it's ephemera. So, you know, it went chucked into a dumpster, and he went dumpster diving, brought out this reel. And the only other copy was a work print, an unfinished work print at the Library of Congress. So I was trying to figure out, well, what am I going to do with this? And I called the Frank Capra archive at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. They have a lot of their scripts and things, but they said, really don't really do movies. You might want to check with the Academy. So I contacted the Academy, and they said, well, sure. So they I mailed it out to them, and I'm sure they're preserving it in at 40 degrees at 30% humidity. Somewhere, I mean, it's not in your vault, but it's in a vault somewhere, and I feel better that it's there being preserved for future generations.
And coincidentally, it was right after that Jim won his honorary Lifetime Achievement Award at the Oscars.
Yeah,
it was a little difficult to explain, but he'll take
Meryl. Meryl Streep was very kind when she handed. But it was not. I'm glad that organizations such as yours can preserve these things, which were, you know, I mean, the thing that we think about is they were, a lot of them were commercial products that weren't considered. They didn't have much future value. They would go in, you know, like I said, they'd go into a dumpster because who was going to rewatch this?
Exactly. Especially like, well, for silent films, once talkies came in, studios didn't feel that they had any value. And there were some, you know, prints were always melted down to retrieve the silver content that was in them. But that was normal. You make hundreds of prints. You can't keep them all. The studios would keep the original negative and maybe a print or two for their collection. But nitrate film will decompose no matter how well you keep it. It's like 85% of all the films made before 1951 are lost. So,
wow. Yeah.
Gosh, that's just so incredible.
So does your whole office tend to smell like vinegar? I was just wondering. I was just thinking that.
No. Okay. Not, and we did have a vinegar room on premise at the museum that would vent out to near where the staff exit was, and you could always occasionally get the whiffs.
Okay. Wow. Well, let's besides the organization, how did you get involved with film preservation and restoration?
It was something I was always interested in since like my early college days, just didn't know how to do it. So spent about 15 years trying to become an actor, and that didn't really work out. And then finally, a school was formed, the L. Jeffrey Selznick School of Film Preservation here at the George Eastman Museum. And I saw the ad for the school in the back of Film Comment magazine back in 1997. And I was like, this is it. This is my foot in the door into this business. So I applied to the school and got in and graduated in 99. And after graduation, I worked in a film lab for a couple of years. And then in 2001, was offered a job back here at the George Eastman Museum and gladly took and have been here ever since.
Wow. It must be, I keep thinking about all the different films that, you know, over more than 100 years of films, just the simple matter of trying to get the right equipment to handle it. I mean, films dissolve, they shrink, they stretch. Just trying to get things squared up so you can take a digital image and put that. Would that be the hardest part of your job, of getting things in a shape enough to get a picture out of it?
Physically, yes, if it's the film is fragile enough. The hardest part actually is trying to keep the projects on schedule.
Oh.
But technically, sometimes we have a film that's just too brittle that we can't even put on a scanner.
Oh, so wow.
We have to send those out to a lab that could actually print it through an optical printer, where they can just run it through like one frame at a time, even if they have to hand feed it. Capture the image, because the scanners are very gentle, but sometimes, and the threading path is sometimes just too much for a film that's so, like I said, so brittle, so dry, that will just break at every turn.
I've always wondered about this. Now, the a lot of older prints that have the audio track running along the side, do you have a separate machine that can restore audio tracks?
We have another scanner that will do sound, because our major scanner is just image only, but then we have another one to capture the soundtrack.
Okay. Wow.
Now, not to get too far in the weeds, Anthony, but it's just fascinating stuff. And is there a sort of a rule of thumb, assuming you've got a film that's at least in good enough shape, it can run through a scanner, but it's not so brittle, it's got to be sent out to be reprinted. Is there, if this is, you know, X number of feet of film at 30 frames a second, do you have a guideline for how long that scanning process takes?
The scanning process itself, for let's say a 1,000 foot reel of film at 4K should take about 24 hours.
Wow.
To scan it. And then another, say, a week to do everything else to it, to grade it, to digitally clean up all the dust and dirt and the scratches.
Do you have a favorite part? I mean, this must be, I can picture this is something that if you're OCD, it's an ideal component of looking at the frame and going, okay, get rid of this hair, and there's a white dot here, and there's a missing, it must be something.
Since I've been moved into management, I have much less hands-on and more headache, but I used to love doing the digital cleanup. The problem is that you do get in the weeds with that, and just, you have a schedule, but it's like you're trying to clean up the big dirt, but what happens once you digitally remove the big dirt, then the medium-sized dirt becomes the big dirt, and then you get rid of that, and then the small dirt becomes the big dirt, and where do you stop? It's just like you have to make these judgment calls that sometimes good is good enough.
if you want to finish
a project.
Because you can always zoom in another level, right?
Yeah.
You can always go in a little bit closer, a little bit closer.
Don't zoom in. I always tell the students, like, don't.
just don't.
Wow. This is much like Joe Johnson, the director of this film, worked with George Lucas, and Lucas is famous for saying that great projects aren't finished, they're only abandoned. And
that's very true.
Yeah. Are you using mostly commercial tools, or have you has the Eastman group developed their own internal tools to do restoration?
No, we use restoration software like Diamant and Phoenix, what we're using now to clean up these films.
Wow. Is it getting, with the advances in home computers and things, is it getting easier to find people that can work these applications? Like, oh yeah, I use this at home, or
It is easier where more people have this knowledge. What the people, a lot of people don't have is a history of what film should look like at certain times, because you can take it to a level that you shouldn't be going to. You don't want to clean it up where everything is so super clean and it doesn't have the look of film anymore. It doesn't have the life of film, and there should be a little dirt still left over now when the film was new. You have to have that sort of perspective of history to know where you're going too far. And then it always gets more complicated if it's in color. It's like, what do these color processes look like? What were their limitations? What could they capture? You know, I've seen examples of like two color Technicolor film that couldn't capture blue or yellow, where they've been timed where what was green is now blue and just distorts the original look of the film.
Wow.
That makes the work of the person doing the restoration, I mean, that brings a real, I would think, a real sort of artistic element to the work as well.
They're digital artists, but they also are historians as well.
Yeah. Do you have any unusual things, like, you know, unusual aspect ratios? Like, do you do any Cinerama work or?
We do not. We have a couple of reels of Oklahoma and Todd Ayo, but they're 70 millimeter and completely pink now. And we don't have the capability to scan that. I mean, we have smaller gauge films. We have like 28 millimeter films or 9.5 or 17.5. These weird oddball formats that were around for a little while through the last century.
Wow. So you spent a lot of time building your own capstans, I would think, to get it to line up with the do you do just my film school background popping? Do you do any mag stock?
We can scan mag. Okay. On our Cintel scanner. Yeah.
Okay, I may be stopping by. I've got old film projects that I've really, everybody around here is gone. So it's, but wow, that's fantastic. You're focused on the moving image, but there's other situations other than film. Do you hold on to things like paper Nickelodeons? Do you do any work on that?
We have a bunch of like the Mutoscope reels, you know,
the Mutoscope,
cards that you'd crank in the Penny Arcade. We have a large collection of those. And last year, one of the students, her personal project for the Selznick School was digitizing a Mutoscope reel. And we had made a homemade system to mount it with glass and flip through it one card at a time and photograph it and then reanimate it from those digital files.
Oh, brilliant. Wow. So,
and we have a lot of pre-cinema, you know, Zoetropes, Praxinoscopes, stuff dating back from beyond, you know, before there was moving image film.
Wow. Hal, we've got to get in the car and just get out
there.
Yeah,
no kidding. We've got to get out there.
I'll meet you in Rochester.
Well, the whole concept of the zoetropes always been fascinating to me. I mean, that must have just looked like pure magic the first time when somebody sort of figured that out, that persistence of vision. I'm almost, but not quite, envious of people who'd never seen an image move. And then saw something like that, and then of course now to think about how far we've come. This whole concept of not restoring something, you know, better than it should have been, you know, back then. I know better is a subjective term, but you're talking about colors and fixing things at the time. You know, filmmakers doing the absolute best that they could with the tools that they had. I mean, they would have they would have given anything, I think, to have the tools that we have now and to do that. But that's an impressive, I think it's a very impressive attribute of what you guys are doing, and shows tremendous respect for the history.
I know that this is like asking who do you like, you know, which of your kids are your favorite, but do you have any personal favorites from the collection that you stop and look at and go, well, that was really good?
Well, we recently restored The Unknown, Lon Chaney, Todd Browning film from MGM made in 1927, co-starring Joan Crawford. That was a real labor of love for us. For years, the only known print was a 35 millimeter nitrate master from France that was made to make 9.5 prints so people could watch it at home. And the film was cut from like 65 minutes down to about 49 minutes.
Wow.
And this edited version was the only thing that was known. And then a nitrate print was at the Czech Film Archive. And it contained almost everything that was missing from this French print. And when you put the two together, it kind of fit like a puzzle that filled in all the missing gaps. And except there are five shots that are still missing. But other than that, the film is the most it's complete it's been since 1927. And this was a film that I bought on VHS tape back in 1992, a bootleg of the film. And I could always like, well, obviously something's missing because it's so choppy and they made films. This isn't polished. And film, American silent cinema was polished. Even at its worst, it was professionally made. So the opportunity to bring the film back to what it was really, that was very satisfying.
I can imagine. When people visit the Eastman Museum and the collection, what can they expect to see when they come for a visit?
Well, they just missed a huge poster exhibit, a movie poster exhibit that was up last year. Well, they can see a lot of historic photographs. There are still some movie posters up in the main exhibit hall of the museum. Some technology, some projectors, cameras are out. There's the historic mansion, because we're in George Eastman's home. So that's been all restored that they could go visit. And in not in the wintertime, because we're in Rochester, but in the spring, the summer, and the fall, the gardens are open for people to visit. And they're always are curated to what George Eastman was doing 100 years before. So,
wow.
That's okay. The
gardens, well, so that, and then there's a Dryden Theater for seeing the movies at night.
Fantastic! Okay. Wow. Well, once the snow's clear, Hal and yes. I will be up at the first sign of spring.
Well, come up for the Nitrate Picture Show.
Yes, for sure. Oh, that gosh. Sounds like a plan.
I'm assuming no smoking anywhere within a mile of the place at that point.
That is true, even when we're not showing nitrate.
Yeah. Yes, here. I've never smoked a day in my life, but I figured I'd just throw that out there. That's terrific. One quick other quick question about the facility, Anthony. Is there, when people do come to visit, are there any opportunities to actually see some of the restoration work as it happens? I know that's got to be, wouldn't be the most comfortable thing, having somebody looking over your shoulder as you're painting out dirt, but.
Usually not. Usually that is sort of off limits. Anybody can make an appointment to see some of the films that we've restored. Watch them on a flatbed. But there are always exceptions to the rules that special guests come by and see what we're doing in real time. And our scanning facility, what we call Film Preservation Services, is actually not in the museum per se. It's about 15 minutes up at Kodak Park.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wow. Well, it's fascinating stuff, Anthony. Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being a part of our show. I'd also like to thank our audience for being here. If you're listening to our show, you've got 100 minutes to catch up behind us. But if you are listening, wherever you're listening to, if you could like, subscribe, leave a review, you know, all those things you're supposed to do when you're listening to different streaming services. You can catch up on previous episodes and social media info at our big site, OctoberSkyMinute.com. And please join us here next time is our final episode. So join us here on the October Sky Minute.
Blow yourselves up.